will still last 10 years like they should. The best of the free life is still yet to come. The good times ain't over for good.
Oh boy, I tell you what, that wasn't going to be the selected intro song, but because Jim was playing that as a little intro music, I can't argue with that. Merle Haggard. Oh boy. Hey, I mean, you gotta like that, huh?
Oh yeah, yeah, I like Merle Haggard.
And of course, we thank you all for being with us and for supporting this little 2-hour conference with the Informer. You can contact us, by the way, by using the chat room, which I'll be in shortly. But I would ask you also to do this and just give us about a half an hour to just lay a foundation down before we start hitting the questions. And there are many that I've already received. But I'm not going to also ask the Informer to lay down his credentials. What I'll do is I'll put something up on the website. But most of you who are listening have no problem with where he's coming from, the fact that he's researched as long as he has. And if anything, I'll just ask him how long he spent looking into this. And the reason we're doing this is not for any other reason but to try to break down for you folks what's really going on, and that there are a lot of false hopes, lies, embellishments, and wishful thinking that's going on in the Patriot community. You got to realize that the cavalry ain't coming and that the fix was in a long, long time ago. We'll just leave it at that. But anyway, I want to thank Big Jim out in Illinois for making this happen, and for all of you folks who are hooked in and supporting this 2-hour conference. And so, Iman, I tell you what, let me just ask you this. We may have just touched upon this the last time you were on, but, you know, when did you realize that something really wasn't right? And then how long did you spend checking out that, in fact, you were correct about what was going on?
1976, and then I started researching in 1982.
All right, and was there a triggering moment for you where, you know, that cast you into taking, I mean, although I know there was for me.
Yeah, when I first started working in 1954, I hated Social Security and couldn't understand why I had to give money to the government to hold for me when I could do it myself. That's what started me.
And, all right, so what was the first step you took? I mean, where did you go?
Oh, I didn't do anything until 1976 when I got into a traffic case where I beat the town and caused them just about ready to go bankrupt. And then I knew something was wrong, but I couldn't pinpoint it. You know, at that time you had kids and you weren't really worried about government. But that's when it started. And it was over a traffic ticket, parking ticket. It wasn't even over a traffic moving violation, but over a traffic ticket, parking ticket in at a movie house. And I parked in backwards instead of driving in forward, where the sign said. And I beat that, and I made them take all the parking meters out of the town because they were not up to par as to having the proper paperwork with the state filed to do that. I had them open up the road that went around behind the school at the parking lot, because you can only go up one way and then turn around and come back out, and that was supposed to be an open road. They ended up having to get rid of 2 police officers out of 4 that was in the town, and they lost all that revenue, and they got fined by the state, and I went before the judge, and I couldn't understand what he said, and he says, you're free to go. I dismissed the case. And when I walked out, all the people stood with thumbs up as I walked out. And I didn't realize what I had done until it was in the newspaper.
And so from these, I guess you could say rather, you know, I mean, it's cliche, but humble beginnings.
Yeah.
You started to look deeper into just exactly what the deal was.
Right. Uh-huh. And I called the motor vehicle, and before I went to court, and I paid $1, and I got the statute that said that they violated the particular parking ordinance, and, you know, I could park any way I wanted. I could park backwards, even though the sign said park forwards. And so I went on that issue, too. So they didn't like me too well. I was in a little town next to that town. It was in near Fort Dix.
Yeah, you're a Jersey boy like I am.
Yeah.
But, I mean, you were, I mean, were you being a wise guy back then, or did you just feel
like it was untouched? It just, I went to the movies, and I came back out, and I had a $4 parking ticket. And I couldn't, I said, what the heck is this? And I went back into the movie house, and I asked the owner, and I says, you know, I just got a ticket out here. And he says, well, I don't know what to tell you. He said, where'd you park? I says, over at the parking meter, and it's after 6 o'clock, and you don't need to put money in the parking meter. And so I looked at the ticket a little closer, and I says, oh, they got me for backing in instead of parking in the correct way that I was supposed to be ordered to do by the sign. So he says, well, he says, I don't know, you can't fight City Hall. I just go down and pay it. And I, you know, I says, screw them. You know, I says, it's the principle behind the thing, because I knew that they can't tell me to park backwards. And then I called the state DMV and got that, and they put me in touch with the highway and department, and I explained what happened, and they said, oh, yeah, well, we'll send it to you for a dollar. So they sent it to me, and I was right. I didn't have to pull in frontwards on the parking meter, and I didn't have to pay the parking meter because naturally it was after 6 o'clock. And I told the guy, I says, well, you know, they got that road closed off. They got a big fence there by the school, and you can't turn around. You got to back down. So I said, I backed down because the car was up there, and I happened to see this parking spot, and I just wheeled the car back in there, and that's it. And he says, what, they closed the road down? I said, yeah. He says, give me some more information. So I gave it to him, so I got all that. And so the town had closed the street. It was actually a through street that went up and made a big U-shape and come back out on the regular street, and they closed it off. And they couldn't do that, so they had to open that up and have the access of that road all the way around. The town just did everything how they wanted to do, and, you know, that's where they were making their money.
And nobody challenged them.
And nobody challenged them until, you know, little old me come along, let's see, 76, that was, I was 20 years old.
Well, I mean, now we look at what you've done for the last 40 years or so, or 40-plus years.
Yeah.
And it hasn't been all about, you know, municipal laws. But,
no.
I mean, but something obviously got under a burr under your saddle so that you would start to look deeper and deeper, because not only myself, but those who are in this conference and others who may hear this also know something's not really right. And so we're wondering, I would say, collectively, uh-huh, as to when you finally said, you know, what's going on the other side of the curtain? Are we necessarily being, one, lied to, and two, in the matrix of somebody else's creation?
Yeah, that was in 1982, because that's when I got involved with the IRS. And one thing led to another, and then the way the government was and Schiff was going along, and I was like him. I was filing everybody, and I you know, kept losing. I was, this particular time I was in the court, and the appeals court, and it seemed to be going along okay until the DOJ from the state walked in and gave it to the judge, and the judge asked me, did I have any comment? I says, I just got it right now. The minute you got it is when I got it, so how can I make a comment? I got to read through 40 pages? Because that's when they hand me a brief. Schiff had just lost the case in Connecticut.
Is this the Schiff that goes around protesting the IRS?
Right.
Okay.
And see, he lived in Connecticut at the time.
Also, I mean, if you can, is there any way you can boost your volume a little bit? We're hearing that you're a little bit low.
No, I don't think I can.
Okay, well then put the phone in your mouth.
Okay. All right.
All right, no problem. Go ahead. Go on with the story about what happened after Schiff.
So Schiff had lost, and the state came in and said that, you know, my argument was the same as Schiff. And I called Schiff, and I said, hey, you know, what happened? And I says, what you're doing, everything that you're doing and everybody else is doing is totally wrong. So I'm going to stop following what you and everybody else is saying and go do my own research. And that was in 82.
All right, and that led you down the IRS situation,
uh-huh,
right?
And one thing snowballed into more, because the more you got involved with it, the more you find out that, and this is real library work. This is not internet
work.
I know,
yep.
and you're going to the library and you pull a book out looking for something, and it catches your eye, and you say, okay, I'm going to look at this later. Of course, you forget about it, and you go back to find what you was trying to think about, and you can't find it. So I got in the habit of sticking the library books with little stickums.
Right. I remember that. Okay.
Yeah. And so then, you know, one thing leads to another, and by just stumbling across this stuff, you start to get a picture of what you're looking for, so then the next time you go back in, you know what you're going to look for, but you don't exactly know where they have it in what book.
I'll just say this, and again, we'll cut a little quicker to the premise of this whole show, but I would say this. There was a time when I sat back before I even knew about you, and I kept pursuing what I felt was the path to find out, okay, look, I don't care where this leads. Just let me know what's going on. I'm all right with it. Whatever it is, it is.
Right.
And then I just, the last thing, beyond all this, I said, oh, my goodness, probably in a little bit more expletive terms.
Right.
And I said, could this whole deal about the U.S. and our founding fathers and all this stuff be a crock? And then I don't know what happened after that, but I started looking for you. You never sought me out. I mean, you're a private person and would like to be that way.
Right.
But I importuned you, and I said, listen, you know, can you help me? And my instinct's right about this, and can you point me? And you did.
Uh-huh.
And the point of the matter is, we are in a fairyland.
Oh, yeah. That is what, I guess me and Montgomery had found this out, like, I found about 1990, but I couldn't put my finger on it, and I was believing the Constitution was going to save everybody, and you could do this and that, and they got to listen to you, and the courts have to, you know, the law is the law, and what it is, and that's passé now. I mean, I was just as ignorant as everybody else
right.
when it comes to that. And that's what led me into believing, after reading case upon case, and you always go to the end of the case. You read the decision of the case. Now you go back to the very beginning and you start going down through the case to get to the end where you know what the outcome is going to be, and it takes on a whole new light as to what they're doing
to get there.
Instead of going down and you're saying, hey, the guy can win, the guy can win, the guy, well, I don't know, maybe, yeah. And you get down to the end and the guy lost.
All right.
And backwards, and doing the case backwards, you get a better perspective of how they are thinking.
Okay, and again, if you're in proximity to the computer, just be aware of that.
Right.
Okay.
I'm quite a ways away from it.
Okay. No, only because we got some breakup. All right, be that as it may, and somebody asked just how I found you, but as I just stated, I just sat here and saying, okay, how deep does this run? And I don't know, I mean, how I did it, but I came to you. I probably went to ATG Press, and I'll tell folks right now, if you want to find the writings of The Informer and James Montgomery, you can do that by going to ATG, that stands for Against the Grain, Adam Thomas Grass, ATGPress.com, and you'll see it's all there. That'll help you to a great deal. The I-Man has books. They're available. We'll talk about that in a little bit. But in the meantime, let's get into the nitty-gritty, because the vision I had, and that which I shared also with I-Man, he seemed to be okay with it, and that was to try to do something that was encapsulated. We've done a lot of shows. We'll repeat some stuff, but this would at least be concentrated into a two-hour block where people could sit there and listen to it and say, okay, now I got it, and don't have to go through hours and hours where we go on other digressions. And this one is going to be the nitty-gritty. And so let's get to the very beginning of the beginning. First of all, as you stated time and time again, it's all about semantics. It's all about terms and terminology. But as it pertains to this nation, we think of it as the United States. We think of it as the United States of America. We think about it as America. Could you just break down what those three mean? And is it important not to mix up what's the United States, what's the United States of America, and what's America?
Okay, the United States is a place, a thing. It's a noun, and it's capital, United States of America. The wall of unanimous declaration have as a declaration by the representatives of the United States of America, all capital letters. in General Congress assembled. Well, the United States is actually Congress assembled. That's it. Wherever Congress assembled, that's the United States.
All right. United States equals Congress assembled.
Right.
Okay.
Now, for the term United States of America, a lot of times you look at that, and in cases it'll say United States, and then when it gets into the real nitty-gritty of the case, right underneath in the beginning, it says United States of America. There is no difference. What it is if you take that and you say United States, you know that that's Congress assembled of. That means it belongs to. The next word in the sentence, America. America is a country. The United States is not a country. The United States is actually Congress assembled, and it represents the United States, actually represents a subdivision of the crown.
All right,
But the word America,
okay.
It doesn't matter whether you use United States or United States of America, it's the same thing. It is like the shoe and the box, okay? The shoe of the box, well, the shoe is in the box, isn't it? Well, it came out of the box. It belongs into the box. Therefore, you can say the shoe or the shoe of the box.
All right, let me try to get this straight. What you're talking about is the Congress assembled is the United States, and it happens to be the shoe that's inside the box called America.
Right, and the box is America.
All right, now, you made a point, and I think we ought to bring this out here because we're not being nitpicking, and that is America is what everybody in the old world referred to this continent as, or at least this.
Yes, if you go out and you go look at the old maps, you will see it says America. And in some of the material that I caught on there on what I've been just researching about the crown and everything like that, it says, on the net, you can go in and you can pull it. Anybody can pull it up. Type in the history of the American presidents. It doesn't say United States presidents. It says American presidents, meaning that the presidents of what's in America is the presidents of the United States. Now, when you actually get in and you listen to the introduction of the president in any congressional hearings or any speeches that he gives, it says, I now introduce the President of the United States. They do not put of America. Because that's a separate entity in and of himself, because he's not the president of all the states. Well, he is now because they're all territories. But originally it was the states were independent, and the president was only the President of the United States, because if every governor signed a law, and he would have to present it to the President of the United States of America, they wouldn't get anything done. In other words, he can't be the President of all 50 states. He's only the President of the United States. And in the John Barron case, they actually come out and the Supreme Court gave that dictation and explained why John Barron couldn't use the Fifth Amendment, because he wasn't a party actually to be able to invoke the Fifth Amendment, because it only applied to those people in the United States, and the states were ignored by the first Bill of Rights, which actually carried its own preamble.
Okay, now I'll stop you there because people are going to get a little bit entwined, and I'm just trying to straighten this thing out, because we're going to revisit or revisit some of these sectors. So here's an interesting point, and that is the president is always introduced, as we see every time he walks in for a State of the Union address, mm-hmm. as the President of the United States.
Yeah,
that's because he's the head, he's the poobah uh-huh. for the District of Columbia.
Right.
All right. Now, United States of America, he can't speak for the 50 states.
No.
Or the 50
states. That's all that means. Yeah. But in a court case, when they say United States of America versus John Doe, well, you can delete America, the word of America, and just put United States. It's the same thing. It doesn't matter. It's
okay.
Just that the United States is in a country called America, like the shoe is in the box called the shoe box.
All right. Now, we have this thing called the United States. And are you saying then that this is something ephemeral? It is a concoction, if you will, a construct that is not really geographical, but is laid over a geographical nation, which is the United States.
Right. Hooven and Allison versus Evatt in 1925 gave the distinction of three definitions that you could use for the term United States. And it only meant what Hooven and Allison versus Evatt said, that it can be a distinct thing in the District of Columbia. It can be the country as a whole referred to as the United States. And the last one, I can't remember, but it was immaterial. But, if you look at the United States and the United States of America, they're one and the same. It doesn't matter. You can use them interchangeably.
Okay. All right. In fact, I had asked somebody who had risen a question in the chat room about this. But, you know, it may not be a bad time. A claim of right has asked. And I don't think, if we go a little further, I'll just ask you to, hang in there. Because, I mean, for the most part, you've got all the information. I can sit here and I'm going to basically play the part of somebody who's never heard this before. And, of course, I'm kind of dense, so in a way it's kind of the same. But I mean, and I'll bring you back. And I know you're okay with that. I mean, you and I have done enough stuff. We're all right. All right, but claim of right has asked something. He said, looking at that whole construct with the definitions of United States and the United States of America, claim of right is asking, is there an equivalent for England? Is the UK analogous to the United States, which he wrote in caps? I don't know if you know what he was doing there, but it's okay. Is there any? I mean, is the UK broken down just like we are? Because we know we are in tow to England. Can you speak to that?
Yeah, the United Kingdom would mean everything that the United Kingdom owns in the world. It said the sun never set on British Empire. So the United Kingdom is a British empire, and it's not just England itself. It is China, parts of the Philippines, parts of the Mariana Islands, parts of South America, Canada, the United States, the West Indies, all those countries that were in the British Empire were the United Kingdom.
Okay.
That's why they called it the United Kingdom. It wasn't just plain... When you say the British Empire, you're meaning everything in the world that Great Britain owned at one time. And but if you're talking about Great Britain, now you're just talking about England itself, that island that's off the coast of Europe.
But did they experience then, I mean, and you know, there's some light bulbs over there in the UK who understand what's going on, but are they dealing with the same thing we are in a sense that, okay.
Yeah, basically, yes.
Okay. Uh-huh. I mean, they have a parliament, and they have the queen and the king.
Right.
Yeah, okay. All right, so you would say that, then in essence, this isn't something that is necessarily just endemic to the UK or the United States.
No.
This is something that's a governmental thing, of course, that's very, if you will, and I mean this word in every term possible, in every meaning possible, it is diabolical.
Yes, definitely, yeah.
Okay.
Like the Roman Empire. I mean, look how much they owned. It wasn't just Italy. It was spread all over.
Well, ironic, and again, this is like another whole 5 hours. We can't go there. But the thing is, you raise a good point. And are we not looking at the second coming of the Holy Roman Empire?
Definitely.
All right, all right. You sound a little contentious there.
Well, from what I just found.
Okay.
Yeah, it's, the Pope did own Great Britain back in 1215, and he owned all the subjects and all the land that Britain owned, and that's why he claims to be the owner of all the property in the world, because that is one of the tenets of the Catholic Church, that no private man can ever own property. The Vicar of Christ has to own the property first.
All right, we got two things going on here, and let me try to balance this. To be very clear about what's going on here, when we talk about the crown, that we can also talk about, like, Washington. I mean, it's a very all-encompassing term. But when we look at the crown, are we talking about the City of London? Are we talking about what now is the power base, and that is the Rothschilds who have ensconced themselves in the City of London? Would that be fair? That may not be the way, obviously, before they gained power in the days of the American Revolution. How does that work out?
Well, the crown itself... could be used to the kings and the queens. That was the crown of England, okay, of the British Empire. Not the British Empire, but Great Britain. But now you also had the crown, which is the exchequer of the king in the city of London, a totally separate entity from the crown, meaning the king. So this is where a lot of people get confused if they don't know exactly what crown they're talking about. But the crown, yes, the crown actually owns and operates the world and has put us in this mess that we're in today in America.
All right, so when we talk about the crown right now,
right,
what is that referring to?
The Bank of England.
And that is run by the?
That is run by the international bankers that, if you look at the Federal Reserve, they are the same people that own the Bank of England.
All right, are we looking at the Rothschilds?
Well, it wasn't the Rothschilds before, but
right.
It was when they came in to be the first bank in the United States. See, the first bank of the United States, it didn't say the first bank of the United States of America, did it? It says the first bank of the United States. Well,
international bank, yeah.
Yeah, and so when Washington created the War Powers Act in 1792, to obfuscate the directives from the Crown in writing the Constitution, he, in 1792, decided that he was going to bring in the first bank because, you see, the Crown wrote the law that this country could not operate with paper money. It had to be gold and silver. It wasn't the Founding Fathers that set this up. It wasn't Congress. It was the British Crown because it was better to control the subdivision that they just formed called the United States.
Right.
And they couldn't, and they would not allow them to use, and this goes back to 1751, when the British Board of Trade wrote the first act to stymie this country, because this country could not get enough gold, and therefore they had to issue the Massachusetts Bay Note. And this is how they prospered from 1751 all the way up until when the Revolutionary War took place.
All right, so we can say that the Massachusetts Bay Note was backed by real reserves and worked.
It was backed by wool, corn.
Right, and commodities.
All the commodities, and it was non-inflatable. The only currency in this entire world that has never been inflatable, because if you took this note, and you went in, and say you sold something, and you got this note, and it said you get so much in sheep's wool, corn, leather, and whatnot. You could go back 20 years from then, in the future, present the note, and get the same amount, no matter what the price is. You got the same amount of wool, corn, leather, and the other commodity that was there.
But there was something real that stood for something that was substitute.
Everybody used
that.
It's not like today, because everybody generally was a farmer and worked with their hands. There was no Wall Street then. There was no businesses like, there were small businesses, but nothing big like today.
Right,
so no GM, no IBM, Exxon Oil Company or anything like that.
What I want to ask you, a claim of right asked in the chat room, is there a company name for England? I mean, we know we have a corporation here. Is there a corporation there as well?
It's not a corporation like, well, it is. It's a divine right of kings. They had their own corporation, if you wanted to call it a corporation.
Okay.
But over here, you can go on to Manta or Dun & Bradstreet, and you can type in the United States and find out that it is a corporation.
That is true, and folks, you can do that. And again, as Iman said, go to Manta, that's MANTA.com. I would also say Veromi.net, and you can type in, what did you type in to find out that Manta came up?
When you go to Manta, up in the upper left-hand corner, it says type in the name of your corporation. Well, you can type in the United States, the IRS, the judiciary of the United States, the judiciary of any state, You can even type in the Congress or the Senate of the United States, and you will find out that they are a private corporation. It will tell you when it's when it was created, how many people there are, who is the head CEO, and the whole nine yards.
Well, the rich part of that is because then they are not under any kind of control by we, the plebiscite.
That's right, because we never created the Constitution. It was created by the British Crown dictating to the Founding Fathers that this is what they were to write in the Constitution. Now, if this is a feigned war that they have, the Revolutionary War, we never won it, by the way. that can be proven. Montgomery has proven it, and I've proven it on ATG Press. And the good thing that a lot of people can do is go to the ATG Press and go to Knowledge and Freedom and scroll down until you get the 25 answers to the 25 questions presented to James Montgomery.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't have to go read the rest of all the – they're pretty long articles. And they're actually the real documents from the king, from the pope, and from any dignitary and any government. And he actually put the exact readings into the into the document that he was doing, the article. And it's like you're back in those days reading exactly what they said, because he put it word for word, the direct quotes right out of it, instead of putting in, like, his words, okay, because he didn't want to miss anything. And that's how he put it in there. So everything you read is actual documents from President, you know, Washington and everything, and so on and so forth.
All right, so in response to the individual claimant of right who asked about, is there a corporate name or company name equivalent
to
England?
Well, none for England, no.
No, but we still deal with...
Oh, well, yeah, if you want to, in the Law of Nations, say you want to say it's the United Kingdom, well, that's a corporation of the king. That's plain and simple. It's no longer a corporation belonging to the king because it belongs to the pope. But it actually, in retrospect, it belongs to the crown, because the king and the pope, when they were fighting, and then the Crusades went on, they fronted both of those parties. And they are both beholden to the crown.
All right, we'll get more involved with the pope later on. That's for a little bit later. It will make as much sense.
Right.
Unless we go where we're going to go now. And let me go back to the outline, which is the American Revolution. I would contend that we didn't win it.
No.
Okay. And you were talking before about King George, and the thing is, and somebody also emailed me, who I believe is listening right now from the UK, stating that isn't it interesting that King George referred to himself in the drafting of the Treaty of Paris, that he was the elector of the Holy Roman Empire and of America.
Right.
Now, the thing is, if you win a war, you draft the terms.
Yes.
If we won the revolution, why is King George laying out the yaddy yaddy?
Yeah, because he really didn't win it. Put it this way. In 1215, when he turned everything over to the Pope, all right, he had no kingdom. He had to turn his whole kingdom and all the subjects over to the Pope.
All right, then we have to stop there, because people are going to freak out when they hear this.
Yeah.
Why did he have to turn it over to the Pope?
Okay, because the Pope was excommunicated, and what he did was he was so afraid that he would lose his soul and wouldn't go to heaven that the Pope cut him a deal and said, I will recommunicate your soul so it will go to heaven, but in turn you must turn over all your subjects and all your kingdom to me.
Which king was worried that he'd go to hell? Was it George?
Yeah, King George. There was Benedict and George. And George was the one that died. I think it was Benedict that right after that took over.
Well, how far back are we going century-wise?
1215.
Oh, geez. Okay.
Yeah, this is 1215. And because, see, the king didn't want to have Stephen Langton, who was the Archbishop of the Church of England, totally separate from England. And he hated him and didn't want him to come in, and this is what the big fight was in 1213. And he finally had to recapitulate because that's when the Pope was fighting England, and the crown, which was actually the king's exchequer, told him that, we got a fight going on between you guys, and we're fronting you the money, both of you. So that's how they do it today, and that's why he recapitulated and allowed the Archbishop Langton to come in to be the head of the Church of England. And then right after that is when he was excommunicated, his soul, and that's when the Pope read him out of scriptures what would happen to him, and the only time the Pope ever did it. And so that put the fear of God into the king, and he relented and turned all of his property and all of his subjects over. Okay, now, let's move up to 1783. Okay?
Okay.
Now, what happened in 1783 is, if the Pope had turned all of his property over, how can he release his subjects over here and then let his land go when it was owned by someone else? He can't. It's in law. It's impossibility because it's international law. So what happened was, when he wrote the Treaty of Peace in 1783... Okay.
This is King George who wrote that.
Yeah. And,
right.
And that's why when he wrote it, it was he dictated all the parameters. And if you notice when you read in there, and this is what people have to understand, that it's not the words that you see as themselves being merged, but it's the terms under legal doctrination that sets the matter, and the king then took charge of everything and laid out the terms of the Treaty of Peace. It wasn't like MacArthur did in 1945 on the battleship on the deck when he had the Japan's prime minister there and everybody.
In Missouri, yeah.
Mm-hmm. He dictated the terms and said Japan couldn't have an army, they couldn't have this, they couldn't have that, they'd have to be occupied for so many years, and everything. Well, the king dictated to the people that was sent over there, Adams and Jay and all them, and instead of Adams and Jay saying, look, you took away this and this and this and this, you wouldn't let us do this, screw you, here's what we're going to do. You don't see that in the Treaty of Peace.
No.
And he then could not give up the land, so what he did is he took and said that, okay, I own all the mineral rights of gold, silver, and copper. Well, okay, if someone owns the mineral rights, they own the property, because whoever rents that property, the king can come in and drill down and
do what they wish
and mine what they want out of the land, and you have no say, even though you got a deed to the topsoil of the land, you don't have a deed to the mineral rights.
All right, so then would I be accurate in saying, as I have supposed, independent of what we've talked about, that whenever you look at your mortgage and such, in capped letters and stuff, you're still a tenant?
Oh, yeah, because the mortgage, if you look at it, what is a mortgage when you break the word down? Mort is...
Until death.
Yeah, a mort, it's the same as mort mean. It's a dead man's hand.
Mm-hmm.
And what happened was so many people in England was having and turning over their property to the church, that the king had to stop it because all of his property was going to the church. You know, the Pope was slowly gaining property this way, and that's why they call it mortmain, which translates over into the United States as a mortgage.
Mortgage.
It's a dead man's hand of the land, which he can give to anybody he wants. And the king didn't like that, so he stopped the mortmain, and they could no longer do it.
All right, let me stop right there also. And Big Jim, who's producing this show, says, you mean I'm still renting?
Yeah,
that would be right, Jim.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he's still renting because he's a tenant. If you look at your property deed, why do you get title insurance Does anybody know that? Why you get title insurance?
Because if something bad happens to your house.
Well, yeah, but when you get title insurance, it goes through international law. It goes through banking. It goes through insurance, which is Admiralty principles of maritime jurisdiction. And therefore, the state owns that because their name is on that deed. And they are protected by title insurance. It's not that you are protected, but it is the state that is protected. And one man in North Carolina found this out, and he has been trying for I don't know how long, because when he turned it over to the attorney went right down and got title insurance on it, and he forbid them to do that, and he didn't know that this attorney did it. So he went back, and that's when he found out that the state has an interest in your title insurance because it is named as part of the insurer or a loss payee.
All right, I want to do a little business with you before you do that, but we got a last question here I want to inject into our discussion.
Uh-huh.
And a listener said, I thought Adams and Jay wrote the Treaty of 93, but that's 83 I think he's talking about, isn't it?
No, it was 1792. 1792 was the Jay Treaty.
Okay, well, good. Well, then,
they went back over into England.
Right, good point.
To straighten this out, and they couldn't really straighten it out because that's when Jay, they're all lawyers. You know, Adams and Jay and all those people that went over there, they're all lawyers.
Yeah.
You know, they're all from the British Crown. Well, actually, they're from the Crown Temple, which was the Exchequer's legal department.
Now, let me ask you this. When they bear that title and they have that office, does that transcend national boundaries?
Yes.
So they're lawyers up beyond anything else?
Right.
Okay. All right. Good. Please continue. Thank you.
And so when they couldn't settle it out in 1792, what happened in 1812?
We had another war with England.
Now, under international law, when you go in and read it, anybody can go and pick international law under war and treaty. Now, if you read that, you will find that any warring nations, two of them, the only way that you can prevent and end a war is by treaty. The United States, any war it has to do, and I've got the book on it, it says that in order to end any war, there must be a treaty. It can't be Congress declaring, that's the end of war. It has to be by treaty.
Now, all right, now, let me ask you this. The reason why it can't be by Congress is that when you deal with a treaty, you're dealing with other nations.
Yes, that's right.
It isn't endemic to a certain country. You're dealing with another one.
Right.
Therefore, this has to go outside the purview of Congress.
That's right.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Now, what happened was, when another nation, when either of the two nations create a war, that eliminates all treaties that proceeded right after the war, the first war.
Okay.
All right. So that meant the Treaty of 1783 is nulled. The Treaty of 1792 was nulled. And what does it revert back to? It reverts back to the Declaration of Rights of Virginia of 1603.
Okay.
And that means it puts everybody back to under British rule. It's British soil. And that's it. It's done.
Okay, so then we just got something in the chat room saying 1783 was the first one, but what you just said was that was vitiated
by the war,
nothing else, by 1812.
Right.
So we're all a bunch of serfs now going back to 1603.
Yeah, and that's why they had the Treaty of Verona in 1822.
Well, that's another interesting situation.
Oh, yeah.
And
I would say everybody should get the Treaty of Verona, and it was a secret treaty. It's no secret any longer. But I do have it in here. I don't have it at hand to read on it, but the Pope controls everything in the Treaty of Verona.
Well, that's when they turned around and said, listen, we don't like this Republican spirit of nations, and we're not going to let this go on any longer.
Right.
Now, I will say this. The Vatican did not inject itself into that treaty. However, that was obviously a conference that was held in Verona.
Well, it was because, you see, it says the Holy Roman Empire. Who was the head of the Holy Roman Empire? The Vatican.
Yeah, but I mean, but it's easy to say, look, this happened in Verona, it didn't happen in Rome.
Oh yeah, that's right. Yeah.
All right. Yeah, so you know, so would I say that that little what would I want to call it?
A misnomer?
No, it's a little misdirection.
Yeah, a little misdirection.
I'm looking for a more erudite word, and of course, I'm not going to come up with that. But I think that that was a deliberate kind of bending away, so
yeah,
that the focus wouldn't be on Rome. Oh, it happened in Verona.
Right, right. Uh-huh.
But the Vatican was a party to it, at least.
Oh, yeah.
Again, I don't think that you can nail them.
No, it's not specific enough.
No, but
you have to know what was going on in history,
yes,
at the time.
And, of course, people can say, okay, look, this isn't, you know, true, you know, fine. But, I mean, there are works like Burt McCarty, also Charles D. Wilcox, who has talked about this as well,
mm-hmm,
that, you know, what was that all about? And that was, like, we're not going to go through this, like, little, inspiration to revolt against the powers that be. This is going to come to an end.
Right.
Okay. All right, listen, we've gone so far, and I'm sorry I haven't had a chance to do this, so let's do this now. Again, you're listening to The Informer. We thank you all for being here. Big Jim, we thank you for producing this. And Iman, you have some books out there. What is the deal if people want to get their hands on them?
Okay, well, I figured, well, being the holidays and everything being like it is, that...
nobody has any money.
Yeah. That I would take the Which One Are You book, the Big Lie 3 book,
okay,
and the New History of America, and I'd make the first two $45 each and the New History of America $25. And shipping is included in that. You don't have to pay shipping.
All right.
And the new book I'm coming out with, I don't know when it will be out. I'm working on it right now. I don't know how. I'm up to 19 pages. I don't know how many more pages it will take.
You'll be all
right. And I'm going to try to see if I can get an arrangement out to keep the book somewhere between $10 and $15.
Well, that's pretty fair. Okay.
And you know, but don't hold me to that because, like I say, I've got a lot more. And this goes into how the Crown dictated to the United States, to the framers, what to put in the Constitution, and that it was a subcorporation of the Crown, and it goes back to the British Board of Trade that was instrumental in doing everything. And everybody says, well, what's the British Board of Trade got to do with it? Well,
yeah,
let me tell you.
Yeah.
I went in and I got it out of the UK History Library, believe it or not.
And where did you find this?
I found it online.
Really? Okay.
Yep. And I didn't think I would, but it's the Council of Trade and Plantations, 1696 to 1782, and it said the Council of Foreign Trade and Foreign Plantations of 1696 was appointed by the Crown by commission under the Great Seal. It was composed of various unsalaried ex officio commissioners who were not expected to attend the board regularly, and it would be the commissioners are the holders of office of Lord Chancellor or Lord Keeper, the Lord President of the Council, the Lord Privy Seal, the Lord Treasurer of First Lord of Treasury, the Lord Admiral and First Lord of Admiralty, Secretary of State and Chancellor to the Exchequer, which is the Bank of England, to the Bishop of London in 1702 and the Surveyor and Auditor General of Plantations in 1791. Now, let's go back and look at who was appointed in 1696.
As what?
As the Board of Trade, which regulated British colonial holdings overseas. October 28th. Now, a lot of people know Story, Blackstone, Pufendorf, John Locke, and all these,
okay,
champions of freedom, right?
Okay, Locke. Mm-hmm.
Well, guess what? Who was appointed May 15, 1696, amongst all the people was John Locke.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
In 1697, John Locke. In 1699, John Locke. Now, Locke was for democracy, not a republic, and in fact it was on the British Board of Trade that dictated to the colonies that they were to use no paper, only gold and silver, so the Crown could better control the people in the colonies, and Locke was even appointed to the British Board of Trade to suggest this. Locke was appointed to the poet trade and instrumental in the Act of 1751 that forbid the colonies to use anything but gold and silver, and they could not install a banking system and forbid the colonies to use paper money as they had done.
So in other words, John Locke, who was supposed to be this person who was so...
champion of freedom and, he was just the opposite.
But
in fact, what happened was Locke was for the crown, not the people, despite what he wrote. And in fact, Ben Franklin, was charged to answer the British Board of Trade. And I'll read you a direct quote right out of the of Franklin's speech to the British Board of Trade, okay? And it says, this is on the decree that they could only use gold and silver.
Right.
Here's a quote. To the contrary, paper money that served as a medium of exchange and credit had made possible for the growth of the colonies and their trade that had profited England by providing greater facility and convenience in trade than does barter, and was the only alternate in the face of the shortage of British coins. End quote.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that shows the con job, which I call the Constitution. Everybody calls it the Constitution. I call it a con job. It was to sell out of the people as it was written by the Crown, and the framers were nothing but puppets. And the reason why is because the Crown said, okay, we're going to run a blockade against you in America because you have no navy, you have no army, we control the seas, and we'll run a blockade, and we will confiscate every piece of property in England and Europe that you own. And you will be destitute in your own little world over there, and we will finally rule you again.
So what you're saying, though, is that England said, okay, we don't have to fight anymore, we don't have to shed any blood, we don't have to pay mercenaries to come over and do our stuff.
That's right.
We're going to grab you by the financial short hairs,
uh-huh.
And either you wake up, or, you know, I mean, but really, they didn't have to invade. It was all about finances.
That's all it
was. And what you're saying is also, and of course it is there in the record, we're going to talk about some of the sources of information that everybody can look toward.
Oh, yeah. They can go and pick this up in, not that particular thing that I had.
No.
But the very beginning of it is the quote, yeah. That is from, just go online and go to the UK, the British Board of Trade. Just type in United Kingdom, the British Board of Trade. It'll come up. And I don't have the exact thing right here.
No, that's okay. We'll put that up on a site later on.
Yes, UK History Library is where it come from. Council of Trade and Plantations, 1796 to 1782.
And we're going to break pretty soon for the top of the hour, and the first of the 2 hours we're going to do with you. But we're talking about, it's all about money. It's always been all about money.
Always been about money.
So the founding fathers found themselves basically pressed against the wall, and they turned around and they gave us up.
Yep.
To save their own asses.
That's exactly what they did. Because they looked down on us, the commoner, as the same as Warren Buffett and Gates and the president of CEO of GM and all the Chrysler people, you know. We're on a different level. We're on a different plane than what they are. And they got a lot more, they say, to lose, and they're protecting their own butts, just like the bailout. Where's all the money coming from? It ain't coming from the Federal Reserve.
They don't
have any.
They could
print it and really cause an inflation and really a drop in everything quicker than what I figured about 100 days from December the 1st.
All right, so what we're looking at, and we're coming up on the top of the hour. In the second hour, we're going to talk about the Constitution, and everybody gets all freaked out about it. I mean, you and I have gone back about this, and even the listeners, who are here with us today, and those who will listen later on, are like we all been.
Right.
We got the Constitution. The Constitution is where it's at, but really, that's been a scam as well.
Yes.
And the founding fathers, and the one thing I find most reprehensible. It's the fact that they would allow themselves to be coined as fathers because they are anything but patriarchs.
Well, do you know, in the definition of international law, that founding, the word founding fathers, means an illusionary corporation?
Oh, wait a minute. State that again. Founding fathers in what dictionary?
In international law, anything that is founding is a founding of an illusionary, illusionary organization, which is like...
it doesn't exist.
Right.
It's ephemeral. It isn't there.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's there, but it's not there. You can't grab it. It's not
That's
tangible.
Right. It's intangible. It's a fiction.
And the thing that they would call themselves fathers, and I have to tell you this, if anybody's ever read on that Avalon site, which I think you would say is pretty good as far as...
Oh, yeah, it is
okay.
Very good.
What Jefferson had written to the Native American people,
mm-hmm.
Oh, God, I am your father and you're my children. I hurled.
Well, same way if you looked at the Bible, it says, he says, the Lord, call no man your father.
Yep.
Call no man a father. In other words, the father of the priest in the Catholic Church, you don't call him father. Why would you call them a father? The Lord is the father. Your human father is an offshoot of the Lord, and
that's right.
Why he commanded no one to call no man no father. That's what he said.
All right, we're going to go to a break. We're going to take about 4 minutes, folks. That's about it, like 4 minutes and 10 seconds. And we're going to rejoin this discussion with the I-Man with regard, and we're going to get heavily into the Constitution. So in the second hour, we're going to really get into the nuts and bolts of this. And again, we'll be about 4 minutes, so if everybody's going to take a potty break or whatever they're going to do, do it now. And Jim, if you can roll that music, I-Man, I'll see you in about 4 minutes.
Okay.
Thank you. here we are after our break music, and that song always makes me cry, and we don't mind identifying that the time of this interview is at the Christmas season. We're recording this on December 20th, and we are here with the Informer, who's been with us for a while now, but we kind of wanted to do something that was a bit of a primer and try to condense it as much as we could into a two-hour show, knowing that also you folks would have questions as well. Now, I-Man?
Yep.
Let me do this. If we can pop this along, because we don't have to explain everything right here.
Right.
I mean, your works do that, and we're not trying to sucker anybody into buying anything, but let's face it, folks. I mean, you can't break it all down, like the history of the world in 2 hours.
No.
No.
That's impossible.
But let's lay this out. The British Board of Trade, I ask you this. It was around, I mean, this thing has been around for forever. What was it, and are we looking at the Fed, our Fed, as being an extension of that British Board of Trade?
No, it's actually an extension of the Exchequer
of
the Crown, which is the Bank of England.
Okay.
In other words, when they installed that over here, that was already installed as the Bank of England.
Okay. All right.
And, it's pretty hard. What I'm going to do is I'm going to try to bring it. It's very hard to understand this because the Constitution is written in very highly technical language. And most people say, oh, no, we created it, and the average person should be able to understand it. Well, it isn't, because I'm going to read you an excerpt from Whiting. He was Lincoln's War Powder Solicitor General. Now, this is right out of Whiting's book. And
all right, what year would this be also, I mean?
1861.
Okay.
The book is published 1861, 2, 3, 4, and then a few years after that. Now, this is not my words. This is Whiting's own words. Technical language to be construed technically. The language of the Constitution is peculiar. It is technical. It shows on the face of it an intention to limit the technical operation of attainders, not to limit the scope or extent of legislative penalties. If the authors of the Constitution meant to say that Congress should pass no law punishing treason by attainder, or by its consequences, viz., forfeiture of estate, corruption of blood, they would in plain terms have said so. Everybody thinks that's what it means.
All right.
So there would have been an end to the attainder's penalties, as there was an end to bill of attainder. Instead of saying, quote, Congress shall have the powers to declare the punishment of treason, but shall not impose the penalties of attainder upon the offender, they said, and here's what they really said, Congress shall have the power to declare the punishment of treason, no change, but no attainder of treason shall work corruption of blood or forfeiture except during the life of the person attainted. End of quote. This phraseology has reference only to technical effect of attainder. The, quote, a working of forfeitures, end quote, is a phrase used by lawyers to show the legal result or effect which arises from a certain set of facts. Note, since the publication of the 7th edition, it has been decided by Underwood J. in the Eastern District Court of the U.S. for Virginia in a case of U.S. versus Lantham, first, that the Confiscation Act above cited is authorized by the Constitution. Second, that by terms of that act, dated July 17, 1862, Chapter 195, as modified by the Joint Resolution of July 27, 1862, Number 63, the punishment of treason is not limited to forfeiture of the life estate of the offender and is not required to be so limited by the Constitution, but the forfeiture extends to the entire estate of fee simple. End of Whiting's quote. Right there. End of fee simple. We pay a fee, a simple fee, when you buy property, because it's always in fee simple. Means you never own the property, will never own the property, ever.
All right, and I understand that, and we've stated that.
And that's why it says tenants in common to what?
What? Now, okay, now.
Here is where the common comes in.
Okay.
The state is the other common because they are a party to it, and they insured their property, and that's why you have to get title insurance.
Okay, are you talking about the state as being the overlaying state?
Yes.
All right, so if you're in Florida, North Carolina?
The fiction state. In other words, this
yep.
state or the state of North Carolina in all capitals. That's the corporate state overlying the land mass that rises above the land mass and the water and whatnot.
All right, so what we're dealing with is an invisible but corporate.
Yeah, corporate entity.
Right, and I said before overlay, and
yeah.
and I think Randy in the chat room said that's beautiful because that's what the UN uses all the time.
Oh yeah,
and so I mean, so this irony should not be lost on us because the point is they're telling us you idiots, you think you own it but you don't.
That's right. Now that's why no one can ever get a lodeal title. Can never happen. Now here's one thing. I'm going to read this direct quote. Because everybody knows about Obama and not being a citizen and all this, as everybody
right,
heard,
right.
Euphoria, the guy in Jersey. Okay, now, here's a constitutional requirement for the president. Now, you got to read this. Remember, Whiting said it's very technical, highly technical. The words that you, a citizen or a citizen of the United States, comma, at the time of the adoption of this Constitution. You got that?
All right.
When was the Constitution adopted?
1787.
Comma. Shall be eligible for the office of president. Comma. Neither shall any person be eligible to that office shall have not attained the age of 35 and been 14 years a resident within the United States. Stop. Now tell me. 1787. Add 14 years, and when can that first president be elected?
How many years after the fact?
Since 1787. Add 14 years to 1787, and what year can the president be first installed under constitutional principle?
Well, you're looking at what? Just across the, into 1800s.
1801.
Yeah, okay. Right.
Okay, now, let's go. And here, for the requirements for Congress are 7 years a citizen, and the Senate 9 years a citizen. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
So, now, the historical fact is the United States never existed before 1787 when it was created. How could it? It was all Confederacy, wasn't it?
All right, so 1783, the Crown just said, okay, you guys are states, but that really didn't incorporate the United States until 1787.
No, they were colonies because if you go and pull the original 13 Constitution, which I did, they all say colonies. They didn't say states.
All right, so 1787, we've got a corporate United States.
Right, 1787.
Okay.
Now, so the historical fact is that technically it never existed until the year 1787 when it was adopted. The Constitution was adopted only by those few that drafted it. It was never put to the people to ratify it or adopt it. Because the Crown dictated the parameters for the Founding Fathers so they could still control their property, the Crown's property, it was never given up by the Revolutionary War. Now, here is the membership of the first Congress convened under the Constitution. And I pulled this out from the library. President of the Senate, John Adams. President Pro Tem, John Langdon. Speaker of the House, Frederick Muhlenberg. Members, 22 to 26 senators and 59 to 64 representatives. That's all there was. That's all the people in the Constitution. Wasn't me, wasn't you, wasn't our relatives way back yonder. The first meeting was March 4th, 1789 to September the 29th, 1797. They met three times. Now, I went back in, and I says, okay, because Obama, you can thank Obama for my getting into this. I had to go online, and I found from the government's own History of Presidents document found on the Internet, and you can't find it, everything in one section. They do not tell you. They hide it. Here's what it said. George Washington was born in Westmoreland County, Virginia, February 22, 1732. He was the first U.S. president serving from 1789 to 1797, but was born a British subject.
Subject, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And the same way for John Adams, Jefferson, Madison, Monroe, William Henry Harrison, and
Van Buren.
Van Buren. And all those people. So now I got that from the publishing company source that quoted everything, that I had to go in and find another one. And it gave all the presidents, but it gave little known facts. And this is where it comes in. And it says, Martin Van Buren, born December 5th, 1782. Uh-oh, he was born 5 years before 1787.
Before the colonies became states.
Yeah.
Therefore, he's a British subject.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But it says, now listen to this. He was the eighth president. He was also the only president not to have spoken English as a first language, having grown up speaking Dutch.
Dutch, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And was the first natural-born U.S. citizen to become president. They lied.
Right.
They totally lied. Because look at 1789 and created the United States. So how could he be called a citizen of the United States 5 years before it was created? It's an impossibility.
No, but,
at all.
I mean, but the point is that this
people don't look at it this way.
No, but I mean, this whole thing about Obama now is which you're saying, it's like, what's the big deal?
Yeah, that's why he would come in, and that's why the courts would say it. Now listen to this. William Henry Harrison. Harrison was born in Benjamin Harrison, the signer of the Declaration of Independence. Harrison was, in fact, a scion of the Virginia planter aristocracy. He was born February 9, 1773, Charles County, Virginia, born of Benjamin Harrison and Elizabeth Bassett. Harrison was the last president who was born a British subject. Ah, right? No. Now, let's go on. I said, so now, let's go on and find out who was the real first president of the United States that actually could hold office according to the Constitution. It was John Tyler, born March 29, 1790, 3 years after the creation of the United States, in Charles City, County, Virginia.
Which means Virginia at that time was now a state.
Right.
Okay.
He was the 10th U.S. president serving from 1841 to 1845. Now, he was born a few years after the revolution in 1790, so he still, you know, still meets the criteria. And he, believe it or not, was against Andrew Jackson, and he represented everything in politics that Tyler was against, especially the new voting power of the West when Jackson's government attempted to restrict slavery in new states west of Missouri. Now, Tyler was totally against it, and so much so that he refused to allow anybody who didn't have money to vote. Goes right back to the original where you had to have 50 pounds sterling or the equivalent in land before you could vote. Therefore, you could never be an elector. Therefore, the common man never created the Constitution. That's proof right there.
All right.
Now, so now we come on to, with the House of Reps and everything like that, and, of course, the technical language, I went through that. This is all what I have in my book. Now, what I like is the quote is, when a well-packaged web of lies has been sold gradually to the masses over generations, the truth will seem utterly preposterous and its speaker a raving lunatic. Dresden James. That's why a lot of people look at what I write and the Informer as raving lunatics. Nah, you can't do that.
Right.
B-Craft attacks us constantly. Well, we ain't Brits, and, well, all right, we ain't Brits, but we're controlled by them.
Right.
And just like in the case of, there's a couple cases, but I put it in the new history book about Templeton. And I told Templeton, I pled with her, don't argue that you're not, you know, that you're a U.S. citizen, and I even sent her my book, Which One Are You, for free, to get her to realize she was screwing herself.
And what was this a case in?
This was a tax case.
Okay.
Rachel Templeton in Minnesota.
Okay.
And just like in Slater, and the judge came out and said that she did not argue that she was not a U.S. citizen. Therefore, she was subject to the tax. It's right in the New History of America.
Okay.
I put the exact quote in there. Now, because of the way that, you know, people have got to realize that ignorance is there's a quote by the fellow on ignorance. It's really apropos, by Thomas Paine, The Rights of Man.
Mm-hmm.
Let me read you his quote.
Okay.
Reason and ignorance, the opposites of each other, influence the great bulk of mankind. If either of these can be rendered sufficiently extensive in a country, the machinery of government goes easily on. Reason obeys itself, and ignorance submits to whatever is dictated to it. That means the people are so ignorant that they believe whatever is dictated to them.
Sure, of course.
Now, in the Bill of Rights, believe it or not, it only pertains to those people that wrote the con job for the crown. The people of America, they can't fathom this. Because the Supreme Court in John Barron stated the Bill of Rights does not now or ever has been applied to the common man on the streets in the states. The people don't realize this. They think, Constitution,
let's start there. Again, restate. What about the Bill of Rights? We all cling to it. What's the deal with that?
The Bill of Rights has its own preamble. It was not put in to the Constitution. It has nothing to do with the Constitution. It is amendment that has its own preamble, so it is not amended and tacked onto the Constitution as if it's in the body of the Constitution.
What does it exist as then?
The founding, the people that didn't want it, the states would not allow that to happen and wouldn't vote on it. In fact, North Carolina didn't until the Bill of Rights was added to it to supposedly protect the rights of the people. But all it did was to protect the rights not of the people in the states nor the states. It only protected the people that wrote it and those 207 inhabitants in Washington, D.C. Now, the reason why the Congress could buy the bankrupt corporations called Washington City, Alexandria, Georgetown, and the District of Columbia in 1836 was due to the fact that the British Empire, the Crown, bought them. They gave the money to the Congress to buy those cities' bankruptcies.
Now, where is the documentation for that transaction?
Oh, it is in, I'll tell you where you can get it.
Okay.
See the report of the 24th Congress, first session, House of Representatives, number 269. It's 1836. It lays out to the penny the bankruptcy of each one of the corporations. They were corporations already. And the United States is a corporation, so it absorbed those other corporations when it bought their bankruptcy up.
So in other words, when people laughingly or tongue-in-cheekly refer to us as a plantation, we are in fact a plantation.
We are a That's right. We're a plantation because the plantation is an organized society under the British rule.
Okay. All right. Now, if we can, and we're coming up on almost on the bottom of the hour. Also, I mean, would you tell people how they can find out more about you and the books you have?
Just go on ATG Press and look at the bottom of, click on the Informer and scroll all the way down to the bottom. You'll see the whole list of books that are there and what their prices are. And send a blank U.S. postal money order, not any other kind. They had to correct it because I was getting so many postal money orders from 7-Eleven and all these other companies that there is none around here, and I couldn't cash them because I had no ID. I don't carry no ID.
Okay, so you want money order.
So it's U.S. postal money order only. They can write in everything but leave the pay to blank. And they keep the receipt because that's their only proof that they sent it.
They sent it, right.
And whenever I send the books out, they're always sent out with confirmation delivery on it. So I know that a couple times when I hadn't done this, and one time a guy says he never got the book, and I did a trace on it, and he got the book. But
okay.
He just wanted to rip off another book. And one guy didn't like the fact that there was a Red Horse stamp on it, which would prevent them from, you know,
copying it.
When they do copy it, it turns black.
Yeah.
Unless they want to go and spend a lot of dollars to copy the whole book in color, and then, you know, it's not worth it because they're spending more for a copy than they are buying the book.
No.
So he sent the book back and he said he didn't want it. I said, okay. He could have made a copy. I don't know. I gave him his money back.
All right. But the point's clear how they can do it.
Yeah. Just follow the and a lot of people, you know, you talk about ignorance and dumb people. I mean, you think they could follow a simple direction on how and what to send and everything, but no, people don't. I mean, they're used to their own set ways of doing things, and they figure everybody else is that way, and they just do it.
Well, okay, now let's get back to, if we could, in the time that we have left, we have about another half hour or so, and we might run a little bit over, but to go back to the real nuts and bolts about this, and this is the thing that's being brought up time and time again,
uh-huh.
You know it, everybody out there knows it,
right.
And even those you know, who castigate me or whatever, and that's fine,
uh-huh.
About this whole thing called the Constitution, how noble it is, and what
absolutely.
A stand that is. But let me ask you this, well, let me just state this up front. You know, all of us, you know, we have no problem with the nation or whatever. What it is what it is. This is the way things are
right.
Outside of mm-hmm. divine law. Okay, we're here. We were brought up here. It could have been Norway. It could have been Spain. It could have been
yeah.
Bulgaria. We're here.
Right.
Now, but the whole idea of nation states is about mercantilism. Now, aside from that, the Constitution, which all these people cleave to as if it's some kind of, I don't know, salvation.
Unwritten law, their salvation, their protection, and all this.
All right, so what is the deal about the Constitution, and why is it hoodoo?
Crap.
And?
Pure crap. they think that, it's a myth, and it was put there to play on the people's mindset. Now, I mentioned at the top when we were first talking about that Nancy Levitt that
yeah.
wrote an
right.
article.
Got it.
Okay. Now, let me read you what she said. And it's pretty much on point, you know. To what we have now is, let me find it. Okay, now, think about this.
Okay.
And all your listeners, think about it real hard. There are certain basic beliefs based on Christian tenets that do not change according to the times, the character, or the integrity matter, then or now. God's law is God's law.
All right.
Man's law changes at the whim of whatever he wants to do. Now, that's the solution, is go back to God's law, the natural law, But the misconduct, as we see today, continues, and the Supreme Court ports it. And it's like making a math problem mistake. You make a mistake in the very beginning, and you continue on in the same order and the same error because you forgot that you made a mistake. You didn't know it. Honestly, you didn't know it. So all your math problems burst on the face of that
right.
First mistake. It grows and grows, and it's never correct. No matter what the answer is given, it's never correct. That's exactly what we have with the Constitution today.
What you're saying is that everybody acts because of that mistake and continues exponentially.
Uh-huh, and that's the myth that everything was, was divinely inspired by God-fearing people. These people were so afraid of God that they did what? They screwed the American people. They didn't care about God. They were worried about their money. That's all. Their property, their material things. That's why you'll never see me or any other researcher give a solution. There's so many avenues that you can go to. It's either a peaceful way, daytime, or a violent bloody revolution, which is nighttime, day and night. Totally different.
Okay.
So a lot of people you can't give them a solution. They have to know what it is. And in mass, the solution, if everybody knew what was real truth against myth and patriot mythology, they'd go out and hang everybody tomorrow.
All right, but let me bring you back to this, because this is the core of it. And there's more questions, and I'm not ducking them whatsoever. I hope we have the time to continue
them.
But here's where I'm going to say, okay, look, we look at the Constitution, we see we the people, and we think it's like we the people.
No, because people, and here again, ignorance plays right into it, English grammar. When I started this, I realized back in 1982, I had to read a dictionary as if it was a novel. And then when I found out that the Black's Law Dictionary and all other dictionaries are totally different than what the standard American dictionary was, I had to read that like a novel.
All right, so let me stop you right there. So what you're telling us is what you found was that, and this is not a really big throw necessarily,
no.
Is that the lexicon of the legal, quote, legal system
right.
Is
like night and day.
From what we, the little people, deal with.
Yes, uh-huh. And you can pick up a standard dictionary and look at a word. Now go to Black's Law Dictionary and look at a term. It's written in terms. It's not written in law. It's a special art of writing. Now, this person that I was talking about, Nancy Levitt, quote, "I tremble to listen to family and neighbors who comprehend nothing, but only regurgitate television news. I witness on a daily basis the unbearableness of individual isolation, ignorance, and powerlessness, which is the very antithesis of human potential. Now we all sit and wait for help from some magic economic source glowing from the TV light, which preaches nothing but moral and legal suppression to which we blindly submit. And our personal insignificance grows minute by minute as we give up self-management to strange new anonymous powers. An enormous and secret power over the whole of the country radiates from a television, and truth be told, our society is not in control of the very forces it has created." Right here, I read this, and I says, uh-huh, she is still in a myth.
Yeah, of course.
These forces are, in fact, anonymous, secret, and very, very dark in nature. It is a sad day to finally fathom that we have all been dedicated and devoted to aims and desires that are not our own. She's on to it, but not quite.
Not completely.
We have forwarded all secret and anonymous agenda that our Americanism has always been a subjective disguise. We are not, nor have ever been, constitutional individuals. I says, she's finally getting it. Not yet. We are our own real inalienable slaves. We are only and ever social slaves. Now, here is what the last sentence. We are cogs and servants to the very machine that we, the people, built. End quote.
Yep.
We never built it because, in like I said, in English grammar, you only capitalize the first word or...
Yeah. Or a proper noun.
Or a proper noun
right.
of something that you want to talk about. And you want to make sure that when you're talking about he, the man, like you talk about the Lord and you say in the next sentence, he, well, wait a minute, you capitalize, the reason why he, you capitalize he.
H, yeah.
Because you know that that is because you're talking about the Lord
right.
and only he said this, which goes on, and not some other he.
Right.
Now, in the 1788 Virginia debates, June the 3rd, the 4th, the 4th, 5th, and 7th, you'll read Patrick Henry. And he says, who gave you the authority to state we the people? And he quoted the P in people. Now, when you say the P in people, it means not the masses, because that would be small p.
Right, it means the elite.
It means the elite, the aristocracy,
right.
those people that had the money that Tyler talked about. So therefore, we the people, we comma the people with a capital P means only a certain select few people, not the mass of people.
Right.
Now, so that's why her last sentence, she still believes in the myth. You can't break it. It's cognitive dissonance, which means that it is so far into the mind that it has a horrible time to assimilate it into the mind and throw off what has been believed for centuries.
So the Constitution really was an insurance policy that the elite
right.
basically wrote to cover their asses.
No, it was, well, they had to write it because
okay.
it was dictated by the Crown.
Okay.
Now, let's put it
this way. But are we saying with a gun to their head?
Yeah, with a gun to the head.
Okay.
Now, if the Crown, well, it did not if, but the Crown wrote it, okay? Now, all right, why, if the people wrote it, the people wouldn't stand for it in the first place? But... why didn't the founding fathers, who were supposedly divinely inspired and wrote this to protect all the people, not just the elite, that's what everybody believes, why didn't they say to the British Crown, look, screw you, you take your gold and you take your silver, we're not going to be bound by making gold and silver coins so you can control us better, we're going to write our own paper, we're going to bring in our own bank and be gone with you. We don't want nothing to do with you. They didn't do that, did they? They
no.
just put right in verbatim what the Crown wanted and dictated to them in 1751.
Okay.
So right there, it is a sub-corporation of the Crown fully operating as if it's the Crown
right.
in this country today. And it is the Crown that has put and installed the Federal Reserve, which is part of the Crown. They were part of the first bank, part of the second bank. And in the Wildcat strikes and everything on all the banks in 1835 to 1841 before Tyler took over, and he was a Whig, and he was against the bank, the National Bank, because he said it would cause so much problems, which it did, that they eliminated the first sub-treasury of the United States that was ever put into place by the president before him, and that became null and void until 1846 when they lost the office, and they reinstituted the sub-treasury, and it dealt in total specie, which meant gold and silver, to back whatever they put in paper in U.S. notes.
What I want to do, too, is pick it up a bit because, again, you explain a lot of this on the site and also with the books you've written, and that's the reason why you've written them.
Yes.
What I want to do is kind of skate across the thin ice of the new day only to let people know that, yeah, if they think they're being hoodooed, guess what? You're being hoodooed.
Oh, yeah, they are, big
all
time.
Right. So now we hear all this stuff, and you know it, and we've exchanged emails, and most folks that are in here right now understand it also, and it's like, oh, my God, why can't we get the Constitution back? We need this, we need that.
Uh-huh.
The Constitution, okay, and I know we touched upon this a little bit before.
Yeah.
But it's a fraud, but how does it still continue to be a fraud? The Founding Fathers are long gone.
Right.
Who is that? Who or what is that Constitution protecting at this very day?
Those in power and the banking cartel, because did any of those in the bailout and Wall Street and all the banking and Freddie Mae and all them, were they ever prosecuted?
No.
No. Well, there's your protection right there.
But I mean, are we looking at the Constitution as it was with the Founding Fathers, giving them protection against, I guess, basically the masses? Are we looking at those same protections for those idiots, yeah, who are presiding in Congress?
Yeah, because they could care less about us. Remember, they are representing not the people. When you go to vote and everybody jumps up and down and screams and yells and goes crazy, they are not voting for anybody. They are putting into office, they think they are, representatives, but those representatives don't represent them, because if you read Lysander Spooner, you can very well see that I go down and I vote for a guy in the Congress in here in North Carolina, so you live in here too, and you go down and vote for him. And we have divergent positions. You want something, I don't. How's he going to represent us? He can't. It's an impossibility.
Well, it would mean, okay.
He represents the corporation because he is installed as a corporate officer, the board of directors.
But I mean, in the perfect world, he would fathom what his constituency wants.
That's
and they would tell him what they want.
Yes.
And he would go back and represent them, but it doesn't work like that.
No, it don't work like that.
Because the corporations have hooked these guys, and they're all prostitutes.
Yes, they are. Now, here's one thing that I'm going to read you right from The Jurisdiction and the Choice of Law. This is by Robertson on Admiralty. And this book is not put in print. It was printed, and immediately after it was printed, it was banned. They could not print the book anymore. In the first place, Congress did not, in the Judiciary Act of 1789, create special courts such as admiralty or bankruptcy courts, with a jurisdiction limited to such matters. The admiralty jurisdiction was vested in the federal district courts. Still, by far, the most important jurisdiction vested in those courts was the admiralty and maritime jurisdiction, and speaking colloquially, they were our admiralty courts. The federal district court were, in this sense, separate courts of admiralty and later of bankruptcy until 1911, when the circuit courts and district courts were merged. Now, why did they have, in 1789, to bring in the admiralty jurisdiction? Well, how is the Crown going to control everything over here if it isn't under admiralty jurisdiction? They can't. It's an impossibility.
So you're saying that the federal courts are all under admiralty?
Oh, all of them, yes. Any argument that cases of admiralty and maritime jurisdiction constitute a specialized subject appropriate for determination of a separate and expert tribunal is drastically weakened by the presence of the right on the part of the plaintiffs in almost all such cases to pursue the course of action at their option in state courts or in federal diversity courts. Do you know that federal diversity courts that you can only use in federal diversity state law? He puts it right in here.
All right,
right in state law. You must use the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure in 1966, unified all laws under Federal Rules of Civil Procedure, and will furnish the necessary impetus for such rethinking of the problem.
Are you saying then that state courts operate under federal law?
Yes, they do. They're all federal territories. The maritime claimant nowadays file a civil action in the civil court.
All right, let me ask you this, too, because we throw a lot of things around, and let's clarify it right now. We talk about courts being equity courts. We talk about it being admiralty. We talk about maritime. What's the difference, if there's anything? And let's clarify that right now, because it does get a little bit foggy.
A little touchy, yeah. They're all the same, okay? The body of this principle That's under the Unification Act of 1966. They merged everything all together. Admiralty rules, federal rules of civil procedure, everything.
All right, where is that to be found?
Title 28.
And where would that be, in U.S. codes? Or?
Yeah, that's the very beginning. Read the very beginning opening pages, the introductory, as you would say,
okay,
in Title 28. Everything there is Admiralty maritime jurisdiction. Everything.
All right, so what should people ask for if they're looking for what you're imparting to us right now?
Okay, what it is they can go to Colby, Admiralty Unification, 54 GEO LJ, 1258 of 1966.
Oh, inside what volumes? U.S. codes?
No, that's you can get that in the library. I don't think you can get it on the internet.
All right,
you might be able to find where the book is, but you can get that.
But under what title would that be?
I mean, 28. So all Title 28. All of Title 28 is all the federal rules of civil procedure for admiralty, equity, contract, you name it, it's right there in Title 28.
But if somebody goes into the library and wants to check that out, what do they ask for?
Benedict on admiralty.
Okay.
Colby on admiralty, unification, because you won't get this book because it's banned. From Robertson, who is a university.
Right, so it's not going to be U.S. codes or anything like that?
No, it will be. No, because you've got to see how the U.S. code. Oh, go on ATG Press.
Okay.
And go into Admiralty, and I have listed every Admiralty rule and where it lies in Title 28 under a different code section.
All right.
In other words, it'll take Admiralty Rule 30, and it'll be applied to Federal Rules of Civil Procedure, Section 14. I'm just off the top of my head thinking of that.
But the reason I'm saying this is because at least if you get people going in that direction,
yeah,
then, you know, they can't turn around and say, okay, this is just hoodoo. The thing is, go take a look yourself. If
you're
that concerned, go do it, as I did and others have.
Yes.
But, I mean, they've got to take a look and say, look, I mean, you're not the one who has concocted this stuff. You're
no.
a conduit through which information passes. And it's going to be all lost in time.
Right.
All right.
Now, he puts in here on different pages. I'm going to read you one. Page 93, footnote 76. A way to attack those in government. The terms of their master's contract, assuming you use the argument of the people of America, which is the Constitution and laws thereof, we have a personam action that are bound by the Constitution by oath, they are, not you. And if no oath in fact, they are liable for fraud by omission and impersonation of an officer under the Constitution. The Constitution is a contract made on land, not by you, by the states. That's why Paddleford and Ford versus the city mayor of Savannah, Georgia, the Supreme Court said that no private man can complain of a breach of contract because he is not a party
yes.
to the Constitution.
But it doesn't only say that there, and that's why when I go back and forth with people, I give them that and Barron.
It's oh,
like,
yes.
How much do you want to go into this? The point is, here is a statement. It isn't just a court's whim.
Right.
This is the way things are,
yeah.
and everybody overlooks it. And the thing is, don't you understand? Okay, now this is
no. They don't understand it because they don't have the education to understand something at a 15 to 18 year grade level. Most people in America, today, by the Writers Guild, and I have a woman who is going over this book, and she is a teacher of English of adults in remedial training. And she is writing a book herself. And I told her, I said, you know, this has got to be written at a fourth grade level because that's all people understand today. And she said, tell me about it. She says, I was shocked when I started teaching adults that they could not understand eighth grade level reading.
All right, but there's another thing also afoot here, and that is there are people who...
They can read it, but they can't comprehend what the words are telling them.
Well, okay, now let me just do a little pontification here, and I want to get out of here as fast as possible because it's not about me. But here's two things that are going on here. We have a Patriot community, which I think we would consider ourselves part of, or alternative news. That's fine. But within that group, the ones who supposedly get it are clinging, and this is the reason why we do these shows, I'm in, to the fact that the Constitution is going to be reinforced, we're going to get it back, blah, blah, blah. And the thing is, the whole deal has been skewed against us from day one. Now, be that as it may, I think what you're dealing with more than a low reading level is cognitive dissonance.
Right.
And let's face it, I mean, and I can understand it. God,
I couldn't believe it. I was reading, and I had no one to help me. I couldn't believe that I was a non-resident alien in tax law. Non-resident alien to me was something so foreign that I'm not from another foreign country and all this, you know. No, it's not. It's terms. It's not words that you think. And I was thinking that I was just like the people today. I had to learn, but I had to learn by myself. I was self-taught in this. I had a good education, you know, back in the 30s and 40s and 50s. Nothing like today.
But back it up a bit. And you were a victim of this, and I was too. We were very happy children.
Oh, yeah.
But the thing is, then somewhere along the line, you have to get the nudge that things are not the way they told us.
Right.
And we're not unhappy American citizens. We're glad to live here. I mean, get to live someplace.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
But the problem is that we've been told that we are the shining star with this and we're all that. And now we're looking at each other going, why is everybody hating us and such?
Uh-huh.
And the other thing is, people, and of course the Patriot community is asking, left and right, now I would like to direct the rest of the family up together, with the fact that they're going, they can't figure out why the supposed constitutional protections are being revoked or not enforced. And my point to them all is, because we never had them,
no.
You can't have something you never had.
That's right. And the fact we're under conquest since 1861, when Lincoln instituted himself 12 Stat 319 and told Congress to institute it, just like Roosevelt was told by the Federal Reserve when they wrote the are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Oh, it sounded like it was quiet.
Oh, no, I'm listening.
the Federal Reserve wrote the Trading with the Enemy Act amendment to the Real Trading of the Enemy Act in 1917 and presented it to Hoover at 1 o'clock in the morning I can't remember what day it was. It was in March. And he says, no, it's unconstitutional because the Federal Reserve wrote it now, and they made the American people the enemy of the banking cartel, not the enemy of the state. There's already the enemy of the state. Schroeder did a good work, but he said that's when we made the enemy. No, we're made the enemy in 12 Stat 319. We're now made the enemy of the banking cartel to protect them from the run on the banks.
All right, so how many enemies do we face, the banking and the government institutions?
In other words, we're the enemy of the state under 12 Stat 319, which was never repealed. You can find it in War Powers when you go to Title 50. When you go to Title 28, look under Section 2461 to 2465. That's when the IRS seizes property and takes the states and all this. And if you go back and search the originating statute, it will tell you 12 Stat 319, 1862.
All right. Now, this is all stats, but what umbrella is this under? U.S. Code?
Oh, yeah, because you go by the statutes at large, and you go have to read the statutes at large. All U.S. codes delete the trivia that they don't want you to know, and that's why you have to go to the statutes at large and argue statutes at large, not the U.S. code. Never argue U.S. code. Always statutes at large. Because if you go to the statutes at large and look at 28 U.S.C. 2465 or 2462, it'll tell you at the end that this action must be made as near as admiralty as possible. But when you go to the statutes at large, it tells you it's admiralty maritime jurisdiction under tax law. Pure and simple.
So what they did was they took admiralty and were maritime and they brought it landside.
Oh, yeah, that was always done. And that's where you would find in Benedict on Admiralty and most of the others. And in various cases like the Jackson and all them, that you will find in American Maritime Code or the Federal Rules of Decision. You will not find this in your standard law dictionaries or your standard cases that you can pull up on the Internet. And it will tell you that since time immemorial of this country, all revenue cases are maritime jurisdiction under admiralty law. It had to be. It's the law of Hammurabi, 1600 B.C.
Yeah, but you bring that up. So, you know, but I mean, take it to the present. The point is, we're all still slaves.
To the British Crown. Yeah.
I mean, no matter who's running the show, we are still in tow to something.
Oh yeah.
And that's why Admiralty. I mean, you know, the thing we laughed about is because in the beginning, I-Man, you know, we saw some people who wrote stuff who probably weren't that versed on it, talking about, you know, gold fringe flags and how this was nasty, and then it went back and forth. But, you know, in the end, despite all that, I took a look and I'm going, you know, this stuff is all over the place, and it isn't just a decision because of a more, shall we say, decorous flag.
Right.
They're telling you something.
Well, yeah, because what it is that gold fringe flag is a commander-in-chief of the United States. Anytime you see the gold fringe flag flying in a court, it means that that is under war powers, under the control of the President of the United States, and all courts must abide by the rule of conquest that the President has decreed in 1862. Lincoln. We're all under conquest by the war powers that was first installed by Washington, then brought in by Lincoln, and finally by FDR, and every president since then has passed on writ off on it as if it's still viable, and which it is, because the war was never declared over.
Well, okay.
The Civil War.
All right, let me do this also, and we'll finish up with a kind of a lightning round where I'm not going to ask you at disadvantage to say things, but just so that people understand where it's at, a lot of questions that just need to have an answer.
This will generate more questions.
Yeah, and, you know, and that's okay, too. I mean, but that's, you know, that's why you're in this business, I guess.
Yeah, but like I say, go to ATG Press and read a lot of the stuff in the former. I get many people that write to me and says, where can I find this and where can I find that? I says, did you try ATG Press yet?
No.
No. Well,
all right.
That answered their question. I didn't have to go and explain to them in an email. And I said, if you want to know everything else, go to Jane Montgomery, Knowledge of Freedom. Go scroll down to his 25 answers to the questions that he got. And that will lay it out in spades to anybody. And it's so clear that even at a fourth grade reading level, I think they could understand it.
No, they can. No, they can. And
but
the people who listen to the show will know.
Yeah, they have to read it. But the average man on the street, really, not the patriots, I'm talking the man on the street.
No chance.
The patriots have to get rid of the myth that they have been under for centuries. And until they get rid of the myth that the Constitution is some wonderful document and yada, 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 and we need to reinstate our Constitution. No, you don't need to reinstate the Constitution because you're reinstating the subjection of the British Crown upon everybody if you do that. That's all it is. You're just taking that corporation and reinforcing the corporation's bylaws that only apply, if written and as written, to those not of our ilk, but to those that operate the system. It's their bylaws. We didn't have anything to do with it. We never signed it. It's a contract. Under Admiralty law, the premise of the Admiralty to seize the ship and the captain is that they seize the ship, not the corporation that owns the ship, but they seize the ship, and then the captain comes in to defend the ship. That's the personam jurisdiction. Bang, they got you. You come in and argue the contract on internal revenue. You come in, bang, they got you because you are the ship of the captain, and you're sunk.
All right. Well, we get a lot of things to go through, and I will say, by all means, don't feel obliged to go deeply into this, because I'm doing this deliberately to just get some kind of feel on what's going on.
Okay.
And folks can either email you or go to ATG Press or buy the books. I mean, let's be fair about this, but I mean, just to pique some interest, and also not to do it, you know, necessarily. So,
yeah.
Not to do this to bring this kind of attention to us.
Uh-huh.
But let's face it. I mean, you've done the work. I mean, we do things. We are not commercial in our enterprise. But in a way also, I mean, come on, folks, give us a break. I won't say anything more about it. Now, here's where we're going to go with this. The Constitution.
Let me read you one thing before.
Sure.
This is from George Washington, May 1775. Exact quote from Washington. If you ever hear of me joining in any such measure as separation from Great Britain, you have my leave to set me down for everything wicked. He also said, it is not wish or interest of the government, that means Massachusetts, or any other upon this continent, separately or collectively, to set up for independence, end of quote. And you know where you can get that? Ingersoll's North American Law Review, number 2, August 1892, page 183. And it's also quoted in the sources of the Constitution of the United States by Ellis Stevens, 1927, page 36.
All right, let me do this. The Constitution, the Founding Fathers are long since dead. Who does it protect now?
Only those in power like Bush, the congressmen, and the senators, and the upper echelon who never go to jail.
But those who reside and preside in the District of Columbia.
That's right.
All right. Now, when you look at the amendments, and a lot of the amendments look like they're directed toward we, the little people, because we had prohibition and prohibition rescinded and all this stuff. So what do we do when we say that there is no constitutional protections for we, the little people, and yet we see these amendments pop up? How does that translate?
That's the fraud that they use. They throw a bone to the people, and every once in a while they'll allow some win that is nondescript and ain't going to bother their or upset their operation, so they allow a win. That's all.
All right. So although those amendments did hold sway, and I'm just picking these out because it didn't
matter. Okay. Well, how they put those amendments in there is through the 14th Amendment. That's all. And under due process clause. And the due process clause by Felix Frankfurter says it's a matter of transcendental nonsense.
Okay.
Means nothing.
All right, although we see that.
Yeah, it's only the due process that they will allow one to have.
All right, so they can still enforce that because, like you said, it's allowed to have to be.
Right.
To be.
Yes.
Okay, and one of the things I bring up also is that it's interesting that Padilla, no matter what you think about him, was a U.S. citizen who was jugged forever, had no habeas corpus, and it was like, well, what happened there? But nobody cared because he was supposed to be a rat ass.
Right.
But it's like, well, no, he was supposedly given the right to due process, but here we have an example of if we don't want to give it to him, he don't get it.
Uh-huh.
Oh, is that true?
Yeah, because it's a privilege. It's not a
right. And privileges can be extended and retracted.
At will.
And we, the people, do not have rights.
No, that's right. Same way with Social Security. They can retract that anytime they want. They can wipe out Social Security tomorrow. You have no rights to it. You have no contract rights to it. You have no insurance rights to it. You have nothing.
And I think they've already done that.
Yeah, they will be pretty soon because was it you that said it about the pension plans?
That they're going to be wiped out very shortly?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that comes from a global situation. I am not the first source.
Yeah.
But, I mean, obviously we're looking at something very, very trepidous. Also, let me ask you this, too. I'm looking at this also. All right, we talked about the amendments. Let's get down to the bullet points, and that is, we don't see this in our history books. This seems to be the province of those who would consider us conspiracy theorists and tinfoil hat wearers.
Yeah.
But did, in fact, the the United States government go where to declare its bankruptcy in 1932?
Well, the average person thinks it was bankrupt in 1932, but if they go on to AD Press and pick out the Geneva Convention rules and the books, which I put, and I did get them,
okay,
they're not in a set of books. They are in a set of telegrams and letters back and forth between the dignitaries, and they never went bankrupt, because even in one point, in one of my books, you can read it on ATG Press, Firestone actually paid for a country's debt to the United States.
Are we talking about the corporate tire guy?
Yeah. Yeah, Firestone.
And he came in and did what? He wiped out a country's debt?
Yeah.
I mean, he's a good guy, right?
Oh, yeah. Well, he bought the, yeah, and he turned it over to the United States for his tire company and for his business. You know, it's one hand washes the other. Why do you think that the United States went over in Vietnam and tried to destroy that country? Why? Because what happened in 1933 or 29, 30, 31 is Firestone had rubber plantations over there.
In Southeast Asia.
That's why Vietnam War was fought over the rubber plantation, and France told the United States, don't get involved, they won't win. But they had to go over there to protect the rubber plantations, because tires are made by Buna and natural rubber. If you don't have the natural rubber, you won't have a tire that will last.
I mean, have you ever seen the documentary Hearts and Minds?
No.
Well, it bears out what you just said, because at that time, the ambassador from France to what was called at that time Indonesia,
right?
Actually, I mean, in this vintage documentary, looks winsomely into the camera and said, Dulles offered us not one, but two atom bombs to take care of the situation.
Right.
And he just looks and he goes, not one, but two.
Uh-huh.
And of course, then it goes on. I mean, so here you have a situation, like you said. I mean, it's all about money. It's all about corporations.
Yeah, that's what it is. That's why we're in the bailout, what we're in. And everybody says, oh, yeah, I didn't want the bailout. I didn't want the bailout for the $700 million. Let them all go belly up. So what?
All right. Let me ask you this also, because as we go on, all right, as it affects us today, we overlook war powers, and we also overlook trading with the enemy and the banking situation.
Let's
take it top down. What about war powers? We're still under it, right?
Oh, definitely, yes. We're not. They've never undeclared the war. The minute they undeclare the war, they would have to repeal 12 Stat 319, 12 U.S.C. 95A and B. And when I asked Ron Paul if he would do that if elected,
he flat out said no.
He knew exactly that if he did, they would lose control and be under peacetime. And they would have to rescind all the laws that they made. In fact, if one really goes down to it and fights this, they can rescind all the laws, the Sedition Acts, and everything else that the first Congress put into effect, because they weren't legally required to hold that office under the constitutional parameters.
Right. Now, you know, in the little knowledge I gained from being in graduate school about communication law, and we talked about this to some extent, going back to those bad old days in the First World War, where Oliver Wendell Holmes kind of cast some kind of votes that he was not really too happy with, but still in all that happened, you know, who knows what the real truth was. What I'm asking you right now is, one, as I've stated to some people who are listening right now, not from the United States, we are under war powers, so we never declare a war, because we don't have to, because we're in a perpetual state of war.
That's right.
Number one. Let me ask you this. To address that, and I'll give you the B portion.
Okay.
Are we continually...
Oh, yeah, we're continuing under war powers, and we found out in Raleigh, North Carolina, in 1996, when we went to the archives and found out that the rent controls that were installed in the 40s were still viable, and when they tried to repeal the rent controls in North Carolina here, they said, actually, you couldn't do that because it's under the War Powers Act. And that was in 1969.
Yeah. All right. Now, secondly, we don't declare wars anymore.
No.
And we're still just going on with our provocations.
Right.
We don't really need Congress to declare war because is it out of their purview, and we do just basically what we want to do.
Yeah, what it is the president declares the war and says the war, and because for the conscience of him and everybody else, and to make it look like it's real, they give it to Congress, and if Congress wants to declare an actual war, they can, but they haven't. They haven't declared a war since 1941.
That was the last time.
That was the last time they actually declared a war. All the rest has been police actions, but under the War Powers Act of the president in control of the courts and everything else by the gold fringe flag. When you see the gold fringe flag in any building, whether it's a church or anybody else, I got to laugh when I go to church and I see the War Powers flag sitting up there under the control of because they're all 501c3s anyway, so they're controlled by government.
But the sad thing is that they don't even realize it, and they will sooner or later, but they don't really realize it right now. If you say anything to them, they think you're a wacky thing going anywhere.
Oh, yeah.
All right. Now we have the bankruptcy, which, of course, did not really happen to us, but it happened on a, a theoretical or a financial level.
A theoretical era because they had to protect the banks from going belly up because the banks stole everything. And, of course, you know, they are under the control of the United States, and they are a U.S. person, and therefore, because they are given special treatment and given special statutory immunity, they don't come under any laws that they can screw you over, they can kill you, they can do everything, and they're protected by the Constitution from any action against them, any at all. They can actually kill somebody and get away with it.
Well, I think we've seen that every day.
Oh, yeah, definitely. That's why they're all protected, and all the ones in the financial system on Wall Street and all these businesses, they're never going to be prosecuted.
No, not at all.
No, they won't be prosecuted at all.
All right, so let me just crystallize this if I can. We're dealing with the overlays of war powers, trading with the enemy.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the trading with the enemy, that involves the bankers. Is that right?
Oh, yeah, because when you sign the signature card on there, the signature card gives them carte blanche over anything that you give to the bank. It's theirs, property. We're only using Federal Reserve notes because they're trademarked and have a lien on them when the minute they're issued, and they're obligations of the United States. And you agree to all the debt, Title 14, look at Section 3, Section 4, you can't question the debt if you're a U.S. citizen. You're a slave. You're a subject, a British subject. It's the same as a U.S. citizen. All they did was transfer the subject over to being a citizen, and everybody thinks, oh, man, I'm a citizen now. I'm not a subject. Well, I'm sorry, but they're in it for a bad awakening when they realize that the United States citizen is a subject of the United States, which is a subject of the Crown. And when I wrote my book, and I got it from Wake Forest University, their professor there, it's in the book. And it's a verbatim quote when he said, the Englishman came over and said to him, how do you like taxation now with representation? Yeah.
You know, honestly, without us ever being together again, even as a kid, I looked at this and going, well, what's the difference? I mean, okay, so the Brits didn't tax us, but we tax ourselves.
Uh-huh.
And, of course, I was like, you know, your history teacher was like, shut up.
Yeah, right.
I mean,
because let's face it. If we, the people, the average Joe, created the Constitution, why would we put it in to allow people to have the power to tax us on our property, on our wages, on everything else? We wouldn't.
All right, so what we're looking at, really, is that even though there was some unrest, no doubt about it, amongst the colonists in the 13 colonies.
Oh, yeah.
And they finally had to go to blows.
Mm-hmm.
But in the end, really what happened was they exchanged their payments to the crown directly.
Right.
To the crown indirectly.
Yeah, because that's why on your IMF it has on the blocking code 300, and you read that, and it's a tax treaty, and it goes to 26 U.S.C. 1426, and that is the debt to the crown that is owed the United States that you, as a taxpayer of the associated membership by being a U.S. citizen, that you're subject and liable to the income tax. Because the Federal Reserve is only collecting through the private IRS corporation, which is private, and in fact I have a letter to GAO, and they finally did their audit of them and admitted that they were a foreign corporation, so I picked up on it from Walter Van Buren when he sent it to me, and I wrote to the GAO and I asked specifically what foreign country was the IRS chartered in, because I wrote
right.
two states and asked for the charter and asked if they were allowed to do business in the state of Nevada and the state of North Carolina, and the Secretary of State sent back from both states a sealed document saying the IRS is not authorized to do any business in this state.
All right, now, this is going to send some head spinning, and I understand that. I know there's some wars that are very hard to win. But I want to ask you as we leave the situation for at least this time. And let's be frank. I mean, and you've always been like that, so there's, you know, there's no problem here. I take a look at what's happening now, and I'll just tell you today, a lady of his and I were biking, and I looked at her, and because I've gotten, you know, some information. I'm sure you've gotten it, too, about what's going on globally.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'll just say the statement, and you deal with it the way you want to. Strike me down, that's fine. I don't care. People need to listen to the truth. And I just said to her, I'm going, look, this financial situation with this supposed coming global depression is what I would consider the very first blunt stroke by the New World Order. The game has been joined. How do you feel about that?
Yeah, because what it is it wasn't over here. It wasn't the mortgages and all this, loans.
It couldn't bring down the economy.
No, it couldn't bring down the whole world. It is the Federal Reserve that is, through the IMF, which is the UN, was created by the UN, and because look in those, in the books on ATG Press, on the Geneva Convention,
okay.
It talks about the IRS in every country. Every country has an IRS, and they call it IRS. It's under the auspices of the governor of the International Monetary Fund, who is running this country and running every other country, and they got greedy and with their unjust weight, which is against natural law and the Bible, and even against the law of nations, which they didn't police themselves. They have squandered so much money internationally that this is what's causing all the chaos across the globe.
So what we are seeing right now, although it's being told to us, I mean, that it's the give and take, the sturm and drang, the yin and yang of the global economic system.
Uh-huh.
All right, I'll catch this my way, and of course you can tell me I'm wrong. But what I said to Lady Viz today when we were out cycling, and I'm like, no, this is all, you know, all of a sudden now China's going down. The bankers, as an extension of the NWO,
right.
is now starting to make its move.
Yeah.
Okay, all right.
Yeah, and they're doing this because they realize that they have put themselves in a destitute situation that they themselves can't even get out of it now. In other words, they played the market, they played the countries too much, and made the loans and everything where they shouldn't have, and, of course, they drug every country into it because every country is a member of it, and it's not just the United States, or America. It's global because, like I said, they played with the money so much because they could make so much more, and now it's backfired on them, and even they can't stop it.
All right, on an outgoing note, I'll say this, and I mean, a lot of folks out there understand about the NWO, they understand the shape of things to come.
Uh-huh.
They're not Christians, and I mean, again, it's a word you kind of don't want to use because...
Yeah, it upsets them, but they are not really Christians. A Christian doesn't right. carry unjust weights around in his pocket.
No, I mean, but you know, the thing is, I mean, as you understand, as I do, it's not a question of superiority or anything like that.
No.
The thing is that, you know, you know he lives. I'm
right.
sorry, but you know he lives.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing is, this is foretold. This is what's coming down.
Yeah.
Be that as it may, folks may not want to buy into it or whatever. But I mean, I guess as for this time, for this segment we did,
mm-hmm.
To instruct people as to what they could do, whether or not they believe on him or not.
Right.
And that is what? I mean, be a little more self-sufficient.
Yeah, that they would have to because they can't pray to him because, he said, you choose me or mammon. If you choose mammon, don't come crying to me. Don't pray to me because I
yeah.
can't help you. You live with what you wanted from your king because I'm no longer your king. That's bottom line. Hey, there is no Christians in this world.
But also, Iman, you answered something that I didn't even ask, and that is this whole idea when Christians get all crazy about, you know, defending Israel and all this other stuff.
Yeah.
Like, these nations were not drawn up by the Lord. The Lord stepped back and said, all right, do what you want to do.
That's right.
This is about mercantilism, and it's about nation building for the purpose of making new markets.
That's why he kicked the bankers out of the temple, didn't he?
And what happened to him 3 days after?
Yeah, sedition and tax charges. And... that's why Pontius Pilate washed his hands, because he refused to give jurisdiction to Caesar. So he was killed. So it's mobocracy. In law, Romans could not touch him because he didn't grant them jurisdiction, and Pontius Pilate was really amazed that this man would never consent to, just give the oath to Caesar and I'll protect you. And the Lord says, no.
He wouldn't do it.
He wouldn't do it. So what did they do? The traditional way
sacrifice.
They did,
yep.
They washed their hands.
And
that's what they did. And he washed his hands so that he wouldn't have his blood on his hands because the law couldn't touch him. So they turned him over to the mob, which is today's American ignorant person who doesn't want us to tell him that the Constitution is not his God and it ain't going to protect them and yada, yada, yada. And we wrote that Constitution, and by golly, that's my Constitution, and I'm going to live by it. Well,
right.
they're living by it.
We've gone almost 2.5 hours, and I thank you, Iron Man, for going over. Folks, you've been very communicative with the things that are in the chat room, and we're going to have more without a doubt. But what we're telling you right now is that, all right, now, I'll give you a last shot on this. And like I said before, I looked at my wife and I said, you know, the NWO isn't something off in the distance. It's not something
here.
We're talking about. It's here.
Oh,
it
yeah.
just kicked us in the balls, excuse my phraseology.
I know.
But I mean, and now the game has been joined, is it
yeah.
not?
Mm-hmm. That's right.
All right. Again, before we go, can you tell folks how they can hit your website and the books and what kind of deal that might be if they're listening to the show?
Yeah, okay. If they write in and they put, what's your grassy knoll? That we go by?
grassy knoll will do it. Yep.
If they order the book and put grassy knoll, write grassy knoll on the order,
somewhere,
or letter,
yep.
whatever.
Okay.
And they'll get Which One Are You for $45, The Big Lie for $45, and The New History for $25, and that includes shipping.
All
the
right.
books are normally $58, $58, and $32.
All right.
That'll only last until February the 1st.
All right. That's cool. That's fine.
And I can't absorb any more loss.
No, that's okay. I mean, but, you know, let's hope you get hit like crazy. That would be great.
Oh, yeah, that would be great. I had to go down to the printer and have them print some more because
yeah.
I was selling so little that I had to make a deal with him that he wouldn't print any more books until I wanted them, and then it would be by special order.
Okay.
So if they order it and I don't have it, I'm going to have to go down to the printer and say, hey, print me up one or two or three or four books or however many, and they're just going to have to wait until he gets them printed, and then I can send them out, but they
okay.
will go out.
We have some thank yous for you from the chat room. I appreciate that. It says thank you, Iron Man, and that's cool. And we'll be in touch, no doubt about it. with time to come. But listen, you know, I never even asked you about this, and I'm not going to put you to the pillow right now. But, you know, I don't know how long you were out there before I found you. Because, you know, like people like myself think, like, okay, I found you today, so that means, like, you never were around. But I had, how long have you been doing this?
Well, I wrote the first book, Which One Are You, in 1990. I really started it as a letter to the government.
Okay.
But by the time I got done with it, it ended up to a 207-page book. And the woman that, she was an older woman. I think she's still alive now, and she's about 87 years old. And she told me, she says, you know what, why don't you, instead of making a letter and writing it to Congress, why don't you keep going and write a book on it? So that's what I did, and that was 1990. The very first little pamphlet I put out was in 1986.
All right. Folks, I mean, it's not the end of the matter, without a doubt, but we want to do something where, you know, if folks wanted to, like, condense what was going on as best we could, and, of course, you cannot do it in 2 hours. You can't do it in 10 hours.
You can't do it in a year.
But the idea was to let people know that this is real, and also they can go ahead and they can find out, you know, more about this in the unsexy, shall we say, archives that are the U.S. codes and the congressional record, where actually that is the story told about the U.S.
Yeah, the best place is go to their state archive building in the Capitol and go back to the old dates on it and specifically look for 1931, 1933, more powers when it came into effect, and get the presidential papers or the governor's papers and read the governor's papers and then highlight what you want and go up to the archivist and tell him, I want you to pull these documents, and you got them all little tags, so he goes up to the page number and he knows right where to go to get them, and then he brings them back to you. And then if you have to go further, go to the session laws of the Congress of that state.
All right, and I'm going to ask you this one more time because I see it all popping up and I'm not going to answer it. I want you to. And that is, what are the prices for the books as it would pertain to this show?
The ones that I gave the discount on?
Yep.
Oh, they were $58 a piece, and I charge them now $45 and $58 and then $45, and the one new history was $32, and it's now $25.
All right, so they want to go for free.
And that includes the shipping. They can order one or two or three, whatever they want. You know, they don't have to order just because they're on sale. The other books are just as good, and they're smaller pamphlet books. And this one here, I don't know when it's going to come out.
Okay. And, I mean, if it gets confusing, they can email you and you can work it out.
Yeah. And all the rest of the stuff is on ATG Press is free, because I could have made a book and charged $3, $4, $5, $6 or more for it. But I just wanted to put it on for free so they can pay for it.
Yep.
And it's there for the taking. And I'm finding out that, yeah, there's some hits on there, but they only go on for, like, 2 to 5 minutes or even that. That's not enough to even read one article.
Well, I'll tell you what.
And, you know, I just get frustrated that people are going on there, they just look at it and don't even read the whole thing and try to comprehend what it says. And a lot of times that answers their questions that they might have.
Okay, I got one more question. Let me just say this. Be frustrated, but it's good that people are coming around. But I got a question here. It says, one more time, have him explain the money order. All right, I think I can do that.
Oh, on the U.S. Postal Money Order,
yeah.
When you get that, you'll have on the left-hand side, pay to. On the other side, it'll say sender. So you write in your name and your address and all that. Leave the pay to completely blank.
Blank, that's
when
all.
I get it.
Yeah.
I pay bills with it, like a check. And it's good because everybody knows that the U.S. Postal Money Order has that money already given to them, and you just go in and they sign their name. I give it to them blank, and they sign their ABC Corporation on it, and they take it and use it just like cash.
Well, the point is just, I mean, go ahead and just...
Because it is a money order.
Order.
It's not a Federal Reserve note order. It's a money order.
Yeah, don't worry about anything else, but just put, what is it, A bar C?
No, just leave that blank. Just
send it. Just send it.
And then they have the letter where they send it, and then they rip off the
carbon, and they take it for themselves.
And keep the carbon, and they
as proof.
And
yeah. Okay.
As proof, and if for ever some reason it gets lost, they go back and they hid this, and in 3 months they cut them their check for whatever they sent.
Right. Yeah, we've done this all the time. It's not a big deal.
Yeah.
So, Randy, don't worry about it. I mean, send it just as he said. And if there's a problem, he'll make it right. We'll make it right. No doubt about it.
Yeah. But it has to be a U.S. postal money order. It can't be like Lower Podunk Post Office. Or 7-Eleven or some of these other weird stuff that I get from, you know, Western Union and all that, you know. We just can't deal with it.
That's okay.
A couple times I had to send it back.
Well, you haven't got a Canadian money order, which is the best of all.
Yeah.
Any rate, thanks for being with us. Happy holidays, without a doubt.
Okay.
And we'll talk again soon. But, I mean, we want this thing to be a primer to a certain extent.
Okay.
So thanks a lot, I-Man, for coming out.
Okay, and thank you for having me.
All right, listen, and you and yours and everybody else out there, really, through this holiday season, no matter how you celebrate it, hey, let it be healthy and let it be safe.
Right.
All right, thank you.
Okay.
See you later, bro.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.